Station number 892.
Colonel Kidson Montgomery, Reel 1. Colonel, do you come from a military background?
Well, I say so, to a point. My father was an amateur soldier in the First World War, and I had various cousins and things in cavalry regiments and in the Highland Division. That's really all.
Would you say that that shaped your thoughts about going into the army and into the cavalry?
I don't think particularly. I had friends going into the army. I think that was one of the chief things. My great friends were going into the army, and I decided I want to go. I never wanted to do anything else particularly. As a small boy, I think I wanted to go into the Navy, but I had some naval cousins too. And there it was.
At Eton, did you take part in any military?
Only I was only in the OTC, my usual certificate there and that sort of thing.
Why did you choose the cavalry in particular?
Well, because I was keen on horses. And as I say, I had friends who were going into it. And a certain number of relations.
But you say it was the horses that was the main attraction,
wouldn't
you?
Yes.
At Sandhurst, after the First World War, was cavalry and horses seen to have a future in the army?
I should have said so, yes. At that time. Up to about the early 30s, probably.
Do you remember if this was ever discussed at Sandhurst?
No, I don't think it probably was. I honestly don't know. I don't think so. May have been, but I don't. I can't remember at the time. It is 51 years ago. The memory is not quite as good as the thought of it.
Was there any discussion, for example, about, you know, the emergence of tanks and mechanisation?
No, not at that particular time, I don't think. Not down to the Sandhurst level.
Do you remember, for example, were there any Royal Tank Corps people came round to recruit?
Well, I think everybody came round to recruit. Nearly every arm certainly had a certain amount of representatives. And I remember that Captain Gatehouse, later General Gatehouse, was one of the instructors there. Very nice man, too. He was the Tank Corps representative. And we had various ones, Captain Dudgeon of the Greys, Major Norman, later General Norman, and various others.
Why did you choose the 12th Lancers?
Well, originally, it's rather too long a story, and I think rather a boring story. Down to the Royal Scots Greys, which I had cousins in, and they had only one vacancy, and they decided to take a nephew of somebody who was up at Cambridge. And as General Blackson, who was Colonel the 12th, was a connection of mine. That's why I really went to the 12th.
When you joined them, what sort of troop training was done? What sort of work were you doing when you first went there?
Well, of course, I was put on riding school straight away. I was only 5-6 months in England, or less. And riding school and foot drill was the young officer had to do. And it wasn't until we got to Egypt and got settled down in January, I joined in end of September, that one got then to individual training and section training, troop training, squadron training, regimental training, brigade training, etc.
Before you went to Egypt, was there some sort of reorganisation took place in the 12th Lancers?
No, nothing.
There wasn't any?
No. Because we, as I say, I was only there from September 26th to December 26th in England. And we didn't, there was no, any reorganization. Merely and simply, we took over from, the 9th Lancers who went on to India.
There wasn't any changes in personnel?
Oh, I mean, officers left and that sort of thing. Because yeah. There was always a certain amount of change when one went abroad. But not many, a few. But I can't remember much happening then.
When you went to Egypt, what was the sort of troop training you were doing, that detailed sort of day-to-day training with the troops?
One, formations, tactical formations, and reconnaissance and the drill and on horses and all that sort of thing. And one started with troop training, after the individual training, one started with troop training, section training, troop training, and then you did squadron training, which we did a lot, and then regimental training, and then a limited amount of brigade exercises, and then the manoeuvres. That was your sort of curriculum. You had a period for quite a long period, and individual training, which was the training of your particular arm, such as the rifle, machine gun, in our case, as well the lance, and that sort of, and signalling and all that sort of thing. That was entirely individual training. And of course, when the trooper arrived or officer arrived, the first thing they did was to be put on riding school. And then one had to shoe horses. That was another thing, which was very unpleasant, because I can remember we did it in May when it was about 100 degrees in the forge. It wasn't much fun.
The officers had to as well, did they?
Oh, yes. They had to pass out. Oh, yes. We all had to do that. And one had to do everything that the troop did. Otherwise, one was no good.
Well, what sort of role was the cavalry sort of seen to play?
Oh, as an active role. I mean, as they played in the 1914 war, at the end of the war and the beginning of the war. And, of course, there was, as I say, places like Palestine. In my opinion, they were still very useful. But I suppose, when on looking back at it, they'd really come to, in a major war, they wouldn't have been much use. But you've got to remember that the Germans used them to a limited degree in the last war, and so did the Poles, of which they weren't very good. I mean, you know, they weren't much use. I mean, they were useless against armour. When you've got the sophisticated armour, it was no use trying to pretend the cavalry, except in places like the Northwest Frontier and Palestine. But in 1926 was a very different show. One got, and most nations got very little armour. So that they fulfilled a role then, really.
You mentioned that the role was seen to be that of the 1914. What was that primarily then?
Oh, well, in my that was completely, fighting, both on horses and on the ground. You see, one of the things one did was you fought on your feet in so much that you got your position with your horses. You dismounted. The led horses went back. And you got on the ground with your rifles. And we had Hotchkiss guns in those days. The infantry had Lewis guns, and your Hotchkiss gun in your troop. And you took on the enemy in that way. That I thought was the major role, because my regiment did do a charge in 1914 in Moy, a very successful one. But they were covered by the Greys on the who dismounted and gave them covering fire on their feet, and a squadron charged and routed a German regiment. But that was 1914. And then in the advance in 1918 rather, I understand that, of course, the tanks couldn't get, were much slower in that sort of warfare. The cavalry sort of got on and broke through.
Was the experience of the First World War then discussed and...
Oh, yes. I remember when I joined, for instance, there was only one sergeant in the sergeant's mess who hadn't got First World War medals. And he was a great, tremendous man, a man called Bill Mabbott, who was, he was a lance sergeant when I joined the riding school, and he held every rank in the regiment, from lance corporal to quartermaster. And he was my quartermaster in the war, he was regimental sergeant major, except for RQMS, he was never there. And he finished up as camp commandant in Germany as lieutenant colonel. And then his final job was Lieutenant Colonel Adjutant and Quartermaster at the Royal School of Music. And he was a tremendous man and a frightfully useful man to have. He knew all the men backwards and all their careers and the officers. He was a very great help to me in the war and a very able man. He's still alive. Not very well, unfortunately, but a very, very great soldier.
And people like him would discuss their experiences in the First World War, would they?
No, because he was too. Yeah, he was the only one who wasn't in the First World War.
Oh, sorry, yes, I see. But was there signs that the tank had come and mechanisation had come? Were there signs in Egypt that the cavalry would have to modify their role in some way?
Not when we first got there, but directly after that, in 1928, yes. It was decided in 1928 that the 12th and the 11th should be made into armoured cars. As I said previously, the 12th did it by the squadrons, and the 11th did it as a regiment, because they were stationed in England. And of course, Bovington and Lulworth couldn't compete with more than one regiment at a time. And B squadron, I think, was our first squadron, and they sent back the B squadron officers to learn to mechanise the bombing in Lulworth. And at the same time, the Royal Tank Regiment, of which was the 5th and 3rd Armoured Car Company, sent NCOs and officers to teach us in Egypt. But, of course, on very much more elementary grounds, and chiefly it was the teaching drivers to drive and so on and so forth, and a certain amount of machine gun training.
Before that had happened, because we'll come to that in a second, but before that had happened, was there any discussion of armoured cars and horses prior to mechanisation? Did you see them as some sort of threat?
No, except, of course, the armoured car role, in a way, was slightly like the horse role. The reconnaissance part of it was, certainly.
And you did see them in some sort of way as possibly taking over from horses, did you?
Well, no, we didn't. Of course, we were very young. We didn't see it. But the powers to be obviously did, quite rightly.
How effective were horses, then, before the mechanisation, in the desert?
Oh, and to a limited degree, were quite effective. In places like Palestine, the trouble, they were very effective. But I can't say that they could have been frightfully effective in a Western desert war. I mean, the water would have been one of the chief troubles.
And was it a trouble that you experienced, this problem of water?
Well, but we never went far enough to worry about water, and they had the water laid on and water carts and so on. And when one came in at night, one didn't go awfully far. I mean, 20 or 30 miles into the desert was considered a long trek. And then you came back at night to water your horses and feed them.
What were the sort of tactical exercises you were doing then?
Oh, we various tactical exercises within one's own regiment. And then, of course, when we came to manoeuvres, you had the best part of... You had an infantry division, a cavalry brigade, a strong cavalry brigade, and you were pitted against each other.
In a fighting role, were you?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And what about reconnaissance? Were you doing reconnaissance?
Well, one did that at the same time. One did one's own reconnaissance in order to fight.
Yeah. Did you, in those exercises before 28, 29, were you working at all with armoured cars in the sort of brigade exercises?
I can't remember, quite honestly. I suppose we were, but I can't remember it at the time.
Were you given much notice that you were to be mechanised?
No, not very much. I can't remember how long it was. But I remember the colonel... There were rumours, of course, and then the colonel having us all up and telling us we'd be mechanised. We jolly well got to do a job and not complain. It was Colonel Black from Houston, afterward general, who was a great, great soldier.
What, he sort of came in and gave you a talk, did he?
Yes, oh yes. I mean, we knew what it was going to be. I mean, by then.
Well, what sort of things did he say then?
What?
What sort of things was he saying?
Well, knowing him, he was known as Bloody Mike. Because he swore like hell all the time. And we've been given this role, it's a very important role, and you're damn well going to do it. I won't have you bloody well bellyaching, was one of the things he said.
And what was the reaction then to that?
Oh, amongst the junior officers, a sadness about losing, great sadness about losing one's horses and that sort of thing. And hoping that the new role might be interesting, which of course later on it was. Technically, it certainly was.
Were there, to your knowledge at the time, sort of people who were resistant to this mechanisation?
Oh, there were bound to be some of the older ones. Yes, I think there probably was a great deal. But not so much within the regiment. I mean, some of the senior officers. I mean, you've got to remember that we joined to be cavalry soldiers, and we didn't like it. But, as I say, it didn't take us very long to adapt ourselves to it. But naturally there was a resentment. But as anybody who's a change of arm as a junior officer.
Did you see any signs of that sort of resentment or feeling that of disappointment?
Oh, there was a certain amount of disappointment and enragement. Most certainly, but one saw a certain amount of it. But there was never any sort of open rebellion about it or anything like that.
Did the War Office make any concessions to you?
Yes, they gave us our charges, which is a great thing.
That meant what did that precisely mean?
Well, one had two charges and then later on it was reduced to one. And so that one had one's own army horse, which one could, if you were in England, you could go hunting on, and on parade. I mean, we were still did a certain amount of parades. They even do to this day. I mean, the officers get on horses, although they don't have any charges. I mean, I've seen parades, what I call the ordinary ceremonial parades, which the commanding officer is mounted, and generally is.
And was this seen by you as a sort of concession by the War Office, was it, at the time?
Well, I was too young to think about it. Presumably it was.
Now, how was this mechanisation carried out?
Well, from the 12th Lancer point of view, we were done a squadron at a time, and a squadron each year, and the officers and certain senior NCOs were sent back to Bovington and Lulworth for a 6 months course, 3 months in at Bovington on the armoured car, on the mechanical side of the armoured car, and 2 months or 3 months on the machine gun at Lulworth.
Why were they sent?
What?
Sorry.
And then the Royal Tank Regiment, the 5th and 3rd Armoured Car Company, were very helpful. They sent NCOs and officers. They lived about 3 miles away, so they came by the day, as far as I remember, and to teach us the rudiments of the mechanised side, chiefly on the Rolls-Royce Armoured Car, because we had our own machine guns. Squadron, so we had our own, but a certain amount. We did have one machine gun instructor, I think. We hadn't got enough of our own to do that.
When was your squadron, in fact, mechanised then?
Mine wasn't mechanised until 1930 or 31. I was the last one. I was A squadron. We were the last one to go.
So that the other squadrons were being mechanised before you. Did you at that time get to know those tank corps people who were coming over to?
Yes, we did. The subalterns who happened to be It's a very nice one, and they happen to be one or two friends of mine. General Mr. Roberts, afterwards General Roberts, who was a great leader and was a friend of mine to Sanders Day. He was one. And you know, he commanded 11th Armored Division, Director of Royal Armored Corps, and a very, very good soldier. Guy Prendergast was another, who was commanded the long-range desert group in the war, and was a great explorer, as was Pip. And Roby Uniacke, who was a tremendous character, and was killed, commanding the 5th Tanks very ably. And a fellow called Alec Dow, who was a character. They were the ones, actually, who... I mean, they didn't all come together, but the four who were sent to us.
Why was he a character, Alec Dow?
Oh, he was an amusing character. I think he commanded something in the end, but he was a... I saw him the other... Oh, about 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, he wasn't in the same capacity as a soldier as the other three, but he was an amusing chap. But I knew most of these chaps from Sandhurst, who were friends of mine. I probably knew them better than any of the other officers in the 12th time.
Now, when they came over, what were they training? What were they doing?
Oh, they trained us chiefly on the inside of the vehicle, on the driving and maintenance side. And I can't remember, I suppose, I mean, probably one discussed tactics and that sort of thing, but I can't remember what to do.
And were they training the other ranks as well, for driving?
Well, the NCOs were doing that. They were supervising their own NCOs, as far as I remember, you see. So the whole thing was a sort of set-up.
During that process, you kept your horses.
Yeah, that's right.
Did this lead to complications when you were sort of doing any exercises together, some in armoured cars, some in horses?
No, not really. I suppose it did to a certain degree. It must have done, because I do remember vaguely one manoeuvre. We had one squadron of armoured cars and two squadrons of horses, and I think it was a very difficult role to carry out from the commanding officer's point of view, but I can't remember it. It's a long time ago. I can't remember what actually happened in that manoeuvre.
What was the reaction within the ranks of the men to this whole process of changing over?
Some of the older ones, the good horsemen ones, they were very depressed. The sort of rough-riding sergeant majors and those sort of chaps, quite a lot of them, most of them stayed on, but one or two were transferred to other regiments. I mean, I can remember our rough-riding sergeant major was Moss, and he went as rough-riding sergeant major 1721st, when they came out. Very good horsemen. But they adapted themselves. Sergeant Hayward, an old Kirby, who happened to be my groom for years after he's dead now, and lived in this cottage here, they adapted themselves very well, except old Kirby's idea of driving was always appalling, because he was, at one period, he was half groom, half chauffeur, and his driving was never a very high class. He was a great character, and always had a most wonderful troop, and very good with the man. But they all stayed, except, as I say, certain ones. Another man who is still alive was Rough Riding Corporal, my Corporal Kennedy. And he went off somewhere, and he finally finished his RQMS only some 10 years ago. He must have been 55, regimental corps sergeant of the Ayrshire Yeomanry. And he still runs a race course, horses, and stables at Ayr to this day, and he must be over 70. He was a very good horseman.
They didn't mind getting sort of messed up in oil and things?
I don't think they liked it, but they did it, and they got used to it. But the good chaps, it didn't make all that difference, because... they were so steeped in tradition, the really good sergeants were so good with their troops that they got down to. I don't say they were great mechanics, no. They knew just enough about it to get away with it. And, of course, they were they got a tremendous control over their troops. The sort of, for instructor purposes, later on, it was the chap who was a full corporal, lance corporal at the time, who became the instructor on the mechanized side. Not the old chaps, but they probably went to sergeant major. Well, naturally, they probably finished their time, their 21 year.
You say they weren't good mechanics. Were there occasions when you had problems on that side, when things broke down and they couldn't cope with it?
Well, you had your fitters to do that. I mean, the point was that they were good enough to probably know what was wrong, but probably how to mend it. It was the fitters' job. And as it was, when you had a fairly major breakdown in the last war, it was your fitters who did it. But then you had to get your vehicle back to your... You had a fitter with you, probably, in the squadron. He would come up and try and deal with it on the spot. And it worked the same sort of thing during the war. You had your squadron fitter. And I'm now harping to the war. It's the same sort of thing. I mean, I made my... I had my Remy. You had your Remy workshops. And I used them, the Remy workshops, absolutely basically. They weren't a workshop. They were called... They weren't meant to be, but I used them as a workshop during the war. And I used to plump them down when we were advancing as near as I could to the enemy, to stay for at least 48 hours, probably 3 or 4 days, and retiring as far back as I could in wireless sense. So, and then I had to tell them to up, stick and jump. And what happened was that you got a breakdown. You had your squadron fitters who were very, very useful indeed, and they worked on all the minor ones and worked at night and that sort of thing when you came in into Liga. And when they couldn't compete with it, it went back to the Remy. The Remy came up and collected it. And they did it, because when once you'd sent the thing back to base workshops, that vehicle was a write-off for at least a month. And anyway, it all